Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up for Monday, March 18th. My name is Magnus Tiefeld. I'm your host for this hour. Joining me today on the program will be Stephen Fan, and he's going to be bringing us a review of the recently performed opera performed here in Vancouver called Songs from the Uproar. We'll also be bringing you a repeat presentation of our interview with Tracy Letts from Moms Start Stop the Harm. She'll be talking about the opioid crisis here in BC. We've recently passed over 2,500 deaths in 2023 due to tainted opioids and other tainted drugs, and what we need to do about it. We're going to start, though, with climate connections and how video games can teach teens to stay calm in a weather emergency.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. By playing a new video game, teens are learning how to navigate various weather disasters and how to stay calm, even amid confusion and chaos.
The game is really all about, throughout the process, saying, I can do this.
Jane Lee is with iThrive Games. Her company partnered with FEMA to create Disaster Mind, a simulation video game that prepares teens for extreme events, which are becoming more common with climate change. In the game, Disaster Mind players choose to face down a blizzard, wildfire, or flood, either at home alone with their younger sister or while working at a community center with elderly people. As the disasters get worse, players have to make quick decisions and learn how to navigate challenges like evacuation orders and power outages. Lee hopes the game encourages teens to talk with their families about emergency plans. And by offering advice on how to reduce panic and anxiety, the game helps players learn strategies to stay confident during stressful situations in real life. Lee says she hopes the game helps players feel more prepared for extreme events.
How can we empower teens to feel strong and independent and competent, capable, and also know that they can get through things that are really hard?
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Welcome. You're listening to Speak Up here on CJSF 90.1 FM. My name is Magnus, and joining me here today is Stephen Fan. Stephen, you've been to the opera.
Absolutely. I just went to the opera called Song from the Uproar, The Lives and Death of Isabel Eberhardt, which is put on by the Vancouver City Opera Company, of an opera that was composed by Monsieur Mazzoli. And it's the story about this amazing 19th century Swiss woman who went to North Africa and had an amazing series of experiences. And the opera explores that, and as well as kind of delves into the psychological and other aspects of it. It's led by Marin Newman, the lead singer who plays Isabel, and she's a noted indigenous singer. And it was also, you know, there are also other singers involved in this. So we're going to play a clip from the opera, and we're going to come back after this.
Thank you.
That was from the overture. And this singer you heard is Abby. And it's at the beginning of the opera. And this is a series of songs in the opera that kind of explores the psychological state, not necessarily in a chronological way, but of the main character. And it's a fascinating production. Because one thing I noticed a lot, and actually they talked about this in the post-opera chat, was the use of projectors. Mm-hmm. So most sort of traditional opera kind of, it was, you know, you have stagecraft, you know, all these elaborate stage sets. And that is both very difficult and also very expensive. And in this opera, one thing that was really modernist and that was really, really cool was, you know, you can do amazing things with projectors nowadays. And they use the projectors to create this sense of vibes, the sense of ambience, color, light. And the characters, they were kind of in the projection, and it was just a very immersive experience.
That's really interesting. They're using like projections and light rather than a lot of physical sets.
Yeah, the physical sets. So it was interesting because I had an interview with Mary Newman, the lead singer, before I went to the production, and. You know, I was asking her, you know, it's a modernist opera. Modernist opera has a certain reputation. Does it conform to that? She's like, no, look, it's very melodic, as you can hear from the music. It's extremely tuneful, but it's modernist in a certain sense. And I think one way it's modernist is the stagecraft is fairly minimalist, at least in my view. But you don't feel like it's bare or it's overly, you know, minimalist. You feel like it's a very rich experience, and partially it's because of the color and light and the images that were projected on the background. And one thing to note is that it's not just like they had a big projection screen and then they had sort of semi-projection screens. They had projection screens that were covering part of the stage, or it was of a curved shape, and the shapes would change throughout the one-act opera. And that, to me, was really technically innovative, because I'm personally really interested in opera. And obviously, a big topic of discussion in the opera world is how do you make it relevant? How do you make it sort of approach for a modern audience?
Right, because opera has a bit of a
fusty reputation.
Yeah, exactly. You know, people think, oh, it's not something they're used to. It's old-fashioned. But they're doing some innovation to get around that and to maybe challenge that.
Yeah, and you know, like there's, I think it's kind of blurring the lines between kind of like film projection and opera and in-person performance. And it's really interesting because I went to the production and it was at the York Theater in East Vancouver. And York Theater, I'm pretty sure, was originally like a movie theater. It was kind of one of just like grand movie theaters. So it really is, it's the perfect place for this kind of innovation to happen, right? It's not a traditional opera house.
Yeah.
So that was really cool. But I also kind of, another aspect of the opera that was really awesome was just being able to speak with Marion Newman, who played the role of Isabel Eberhardt in the opera, which is obviously a leading role. And I got to speak with her because she's of indigenous heritage, but she's also just in every way a phenomenal, just traditional opera singer, right? Mm-hmm. She's both. And they kind of combine, but they don't kind of detract from each other in any way. And I kind of asked her about her experiences in the opera world. And, you know, there's just, you know, some amazing stories, right? And it's kind of like, you know, opera is can be this kind of very old-fashioned thing, but it can also be a really relevant thing. I think it was one thing I always kind of found interesting was that back in the day, you know, back in the 19th century, for example, opera was not this kind of fusty thing that you stuck in a corner in a cabinet shop somewhere. For example, the country of Belgium, the Kingdom of Belgium, the Belgian Revolution that created the country was born out of an opera performance. because in 1930, the Belgian Revolution, literally a bunch of, you know, townspeople went to an opera, and there was like a slave chorus or something in one of the grand operas, and they were really kind of moved by this. And then they went out on the streets and they had to stage the Belgian Revolution that created the country.
Right.
And
awesome.
So opera can be a really dynamic force.
And of course, it used to be, you know, as with a lot of what we consider classical music, you know, it was popular music in its day.
Oh, absolutely. Like, you know, like, we forget pretty much everything that we consider classical music started out as, you know, popular music in the same way Fiddy or whatever it is now. Like, I mean, I don't know if Fiddy will be, you know, in 100 years considered classical music. That's yet to be seen. But, you know, although we're pretty sure that the Beatles will be considered classical music, right? But, like, you know, the one of the most famous singers in classical music in 19th century, she was like, the Taylor Swift of her day, Lind, and it was crazy. And same thing was, you know, Franz Liszt, who was this famous composer and pianist, and Pagliacci, and just like all these people were Paganini, sorry, and all these people were superstars of their day. And you know, I have a background in classical music. I started studying the piano when I was 4 and a half, and I studied it throughout my childhood and adolescence. And one thing I've always felt very strongly about is we don't want to make this too fussy. Because in classical music, there's always this debate, you know, are we being authentic? Is this kind of the authentic way to do these things? And I tell you this, you know, I've studied a lot of music history. The composers of these pieces of music would have been the last people to insist on authenticity. Right. They really want to experiment with these. I'm sure, and there are written records of this. They wanted people to experiment with this. They wanted people to have the maximum impact. They were very interested in impact. They were not kind of very interested in, oh, you know, are they obeying my kind of tempo instructions?
Yes.
So it's a crazy world, kind of in that sense.
So would you say this production fits the expectations of a modern audience? Is it?
I thought. Yeah, go on.
No, that's my question.
I think, you know, like, it's a really interesting opera, and it's not a purely experimental opera. Missy Mazzoli, who's the composer of this opera, was called, I think, by the New York Times or another newspaper, the post-millennial Mozart of Brooklyn. it's a very established opera in many ways. It's been performed elsewhere. And there were two performances in Vancouver, the first on the 29th of February and the second on 2nd of March. Another performance on March 3rd, the matinee performance.
Yeah.
But, like, it's not a purely experimental opera, but the thing I find incredible about the opera, and the thing I took away from the experience, as well as something else, which I'll mention later, is it points a way to the future in which opera could be more rather than less relevant to people's lives. Because in the era of cuts in arts funding, opera, which is without question the most expensive of the classical forms of musical performance, that obviously impacts opera more than anyone else because, you know, you have an orchestra, you have stagecraft. These things get very, very expensive. If you could not only reduce expenditure, but actually enhance the experience through the use of modern technology, not like replacing opera, but kind of do enhance it with like projections and light works, which is like an established discipline, I think that could make a lot of performances of not just of modernist opera, like this one, like Song from the Uproar, successful, but also just traditional repertoire as well, right? You know, like, I've seen multiple performances of the Magic Flute. Magic Flute was originally written in the 18th century as a light opera. It was meant as a light, inexpensive production, but a modern production of a light opera is not that cheap.
Right.
And, you know, it's just, if you can make that more accessible, not just in terms of viewership, like, you know, in a sense of watching the Met on Sundays or whatever on TV, but just, you know, something participatory, then I think that could be a really interesting thing that could be happening.
Certainly I can see how bringing in sort of the modern capabilities of lighting would help a production sort of match what people expect these days. You know, I mean, people expect, they go to any kind of concert and they're expecting a certain amount of flash from the lighting, and it you know, and you know, when productions are filmed, there's lots of quick cuts and stuff, and you can sort of create that sort of vibe with the lighting while still staying true to the music.
Yeah, like, it's ultimately, the things that are kind of like, it gives you a shiver down your back when you're going to an opera is not like the precise, elements of the stagecraft. It is kind of the aria, like the masterful singing. That's not going to go away, and I wouldn't want for that to go away. But there are other elements which can be sort of improved upon. And I think it's good that people are experimenting with this. And, because personally I'm a little bit of a projection fanatic in my own house. I have multiple projectors. So that was perfect for me in terms of something I was looking into. But, like, I was just kind of stunned by it. I thought it was really cool. And because, I want opera to be more people's lives. But you got to make it more accessible economically. Mm. Just put on.
Great. So will there be another chance for listeners to see this production?
Not in front of me, not to my knowledge right now. I'm sure it'll come back in some form. It's a really popular production. The City Opera of Vancouver has other really interesting productions as well this season. But it's. I think this opera is here to stay, right? And so... Great. I don't know yet, but it's definitely going to be here sometime. And yes, just a shout out to Vancouver City Opera. They have a thing called a Hafu Project by Luca Covabata. Weirdly, I didn't know this before going on the show. I actually know Luca Covabata. I went to school with them. Yes. But I was not aware of this. But it looks like a really interesting project they're doing for June. And it's kind of like a Japanese fusion thing. Excellent. And so that's going to be really cool. And by the way, I just want to give a shout out to, Pepino's, because I'm a little bit of a gourmand. I went to the opera, I stayed for the talk, and I got really hungry. And it turns out next door to the York Theater was Pepino's, apparently one of the best Italian restaurants in the city. And I went there, had some great Vongoli linguine. So that was good.
Well, it sounds like it could be a night out when they have their next production coming up.
Absolutely.
Once again, just summarize the play again, or not the play, but the opera.
Yeah, the opera is called Song from the Uproar, The Life and Death of Isabel Eberhardt. And it's the story about a Swiss woman, 100 years ago, who goes to Morocco and has a series of transformative experiences there, and it's really cool. I mean, actually, I'll give you a short excerpt. It's at age 20, after the death of her mother, she left her life in Switzerland for a nomadic and unfettered existence in the deserts of North Africa. She traveled extensively through the desert on horseback, often dressed as a man, relentlessly documenting her travels through detailed journals. At age 27, Isabel drowned in a flash flood in a desert. And the beautiful thing about this opera is actually it's not a chronological telling of that story. It's like a series of flashbacks. Mm-hmm. And that was sort of really cool, really trippy in a way, as trippy as it gets without taking drugs. Just kind of a very wild experience.
Excellent. Well, it sounds like a fascinating production, and we should be looking for more from the City Opera.
Absolutely.
All right. Thanks so much, Stephen.
A pleasure.
Stephen Fan is our opera correspondent here at CJSF.
Alrighty.
Thank you to Stephen Fan for that review of the opera Songs from the Uproar, The Life and Death of Isabel Eberhardt. Sadly, the run for that opera is complete now, but if you're looking for something to do this week, you can check out Pussy Riot at the Polygon Gallery on the North Shore. Pussy Riot are the infamous Russian activists and agitators who've taken a very public and prominent role in opposing the government of Vladimir Putin. They have been imprisoned, they have been harassed, and they've been forced into exile. They're going to be appearing at the Polygon Gallery this Thursday evening at 6 o'clock to give a talk and take questions. It should be very interesting. Admission is free, although you are advised to RSV to reserve your spot. You can do that by going to the Polygon Gallery's website. And it's a fairly simple process. So that's Pussy Riot appearing at the Polygon this Thursday evening at 6 o'clock. Check it out. They are so bold and so brave, and I'm really looking forward to hearing from them. Now we're going to go give you another presentation of our interview with Tracy Letts. She is the board chair of Moms Stop the Harm. Moms Stop the Harm is a national organization made up of family and loved ones of people suffering from addiction. They are very close to the issue and have a particular viewpoint and a lot of strong and I think very well-informed views. Tracy Letts herself recently suffered the loss of her son just earlier this year. He will become one of the statistics for 2024. In 2023, over 2,500 people died from tainted drugs in BC. It's the kind of crisis that can affect so many because you don't have to be an entrenched addict. You don't have to be in the streets for a long time. You could be anyone experimenting or trying recreational drugs, and you could find yourself suddenly with a tainted supply and a terrible outcome. This is my interview with Tracy Letts, conducted just a few weeks ago. All right, joining me now is Tracy Letts, Board Vice Chair of Moms Stop the Harm. Before we get into things, maybe you can tell me, what is Moms Stop the Harm?
Moms Stop the Harm is a pan-Canadian organization that all our members generally have experienced harms one way or another with somebody's that they love substance use, right down to, you know, supporting people that are in active addiction as well as those who have lost their loved ones.
Great. So last month, the BC coroner announced or released their report on the opioid crisis in 2023. And we set a new record of opioid deaths in BC of 2,511, or almost 7 deaths per day. Why aren't we making more progress on the opioid epidemic?
I think, you know, the drug supply is getting increasingly toxic. And I think in general, that is unprecedented. People don't really know what to do on this. Like, if we look back on Lisa LaPointe's report, one of the first things that she said is that we need to address the toxicity of the drug supply and to curtail the deaths. And by doing so, to do that in an appropriate way would be to introduce a legal regulated supply, or maybe not legal, but a regulated supply of substances that people are using at the moment.
Right. There's a lot of contention around what to do about the issue. There was just in Richmond earlier this month, there's a proposal to open a safe injection center, which met a lot of public opposition. And was ultimately turned down. What do we need to? How do we address, you know, the public's fears around treatment for addiction?
Well, I think it's a matter of, it is fear, and it's fear of the unknown, and fear of that this could happen within your own family, and fear that it is happening and you don't know what to do about it. And it doesn't help that we're also getting a lot of narrative out there, particularly in the press, from certain political organizations and groups that seem to, you know, have grabbed onto this and are perpetrating that fear within people. So, you know, what happened in Richmond is just a lack of knowledge, a lack of education amongst the citizens there. And I think that is something that when, you know, you're looking to propose a site such as that one, and I was really surprised that they went about it in the way that they did, bringing it through council in that regards.
In what way?
Well, generally, you know, health authorities have a lot of leeway in what they can and cannot put on in their own institutions on their own land. And I know within, say, Fraser Health Region, you know, opening up an OPS or a safe consumption site is something they can do without council's approval. Mm-hmm. And so I think the way they went about this instigated a lot of fear in the community because lack of understanding of what it actually entails, what a safe consumption site is or an overdose prevention site.
I guess opening it up to a sort of political forum really changes the nature of the discussion on the issue.
It generally does. So it comes down to, like I said, putting in a site such as that should start at a grassroots level, and it should start with educating the community around it. And that just didn't seem to be done at this point, in particular in Richmond. There was a huge amount of opposition, and it, from what I understand, it also got fairly nasty, mm-hmm. what was happening there. And like, it is, it's based in fear, it's based in the unknown, and a perception of what people who use substances look like and how they act and who they are. And that fear is being spread, you know, through certain right wing, I hate to say that, but right wing organizations and media. And it's really, it just compounds the stigma, and it compounds isolation, and it is a leading contributor to people dying.
Yeah, there's a great deal of othering that goes on in the discussions around addiction. Certainly, you know, what I heard people saying through the media on the Richmond discussion, or the council discussion there, involved a great deal of othering of who are people with addiction. Mom Stop the Harm is very much an organization that is very close to the issues of addiction. That's the case for you as well.
It is. You know, this isn't an organization that you just kind of look up online and decide, I'm going to join this today. Every single one of our members has lived experience, whether it's with addiction ourselves or with people that we support and that we love. And it's also one of the main goals of Mom Stop the Harm is to reduce deaths, stop the dying. And we really look at that and do that through education. So we educate our membership, we go out and we educate in public, and we just kind of look at reducing the stigma and the fear that surrounds that. It's if we look at Lisa LaPointe's report again, you know, they've identified 225,000 approximate substance users in the province of BC. And out of that, the majority of them, and we can look at about 80%, if not more, just based on the data that's out there, are either using in isolation, using alone, and are not the typical, you know, like what we're seeing in media, seeing, you know, the photos that end up being out there. There are also not the people that are going to be using a safe consumption site. They may stop by, pick up harm reduction supplies. But it's the face of somebody struggling with addiction is my face. It's your face. It's the face of so many people out there. And the majority of people don't know, and they don't understand that.
And you've personally experienced the loss of addiction to addiction.
I did. I lost my son this past February.
I'm really sorry to you've had to go through that.
Yeah, I am too. Sorry.
I bet. What can you say as a parent who's lost a loved one, lost a child, to people who don't understand what we need to do?
You know, I get a lot of people that come up, and just, I think, because I do talk about it. And I think that's the number one thing, is we have to talk about it. We have to talk about addiction and just substance use in general. And we have to teach our children, and we have to educate youth on what substance use is. And it's not the typical DARE programs. It's not, you know, the things of the past. Obviously, that hasn't worked, or we wouldn't be in the crisis that we're in now. But I think education and open conversation is really the way to start this. Reduce stigma around drug and substance use, and learn to talk to your kids and provide a safe space for them to be able to come to you with their questions, with their concerns, and react in a way that knowledgeable way, and not just off the cuff out of fear. So yeah, for me, it's, you know, in my journey, when I started on this, I had no clue what was going on. And it has been a really